blurring the bright line between fiction and real life.
One of the things that I play around with is that line between fiction and nonfiction, and what's real and what isn't real. And I, like all writers, do draw from my life and other people's lives. This is the danger in having a friend who's a writer. And there are, I guess, very important parts of Julia's story that are my story.
That's Veronica Gonzalez Peña talking about her novel, The Sad Passions. And mountains of plastic trash are piling up on Alaska's formerly pristine beaches.
I found that even in Alaska, which we mostly think of as a place very remote from most people, that on a lot of the beaches, there is just an incredible amount of plastic stuff that is accumulating all the time.
That's ecologist Carl Safina. He went with a group of scientists and artists to the shores of Alaska. A documentary film called Gyre, Creating Art from a Plastic Ocean, has just been released by National Geographic. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. What's it like to grow up the daughter of a mother with mental illness, especially when it means negotiating the dangerous, unpredictable shoals of a parent's manic depression? It's something my guest, Veronica Gonzalez Peña, explores in her terrific new novel, The Sad Passions. Peña's own mother had manic depression, or as it's more commonly known these days, bipolar disorder. Her own experience becomes a launching point to imagine how four different daughters confront their mother's illness and create their own identities. The family lives in Mexico in the early 1960s. There is mother, Claudia, and her daughters, Rocio, the parentified eldest child, Julia, who was given away at the age of six to be raised by her uncle, Marta, the acting-out bad girl, who is both like her mother and struggles to differentiate herself from her, and finally the youngest, Sandra, the resilient one, who uses her powers of extrasensory perception to make meaning of her family's sad passions. Veronica Gonzalez Peña has won the Aztlán Prize for Latino Literature. In addition to The Sad Passions, she's the author of Twin Time, or How Death Befell Me. Her work has been published in the Massachusetts Review and New World Young Latino Writers, among other publications. Veronica Gonzalez Peña, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Francesca.
Well, your novel, The Sad Passions, I'd say broke upon my firmament like a sunburst. It was just an amazing, amazing book. And I had not known of you as a writer before this. I think you're an extraordinary writer.
Oh, and, thank you. That's a great compliment.
And this is a multi-layered book in many ways. It has intertwining stories. It goes back over the same incidences at different times from different points of view. And I even have a sense that there is some intersection of reality with your own life, although I don't know exactly what the dimensions of that may be. So this is a book about a mother and her four daughters, a mother who is deeply disturbed. Tell us first about her. Tell us about Claudia.
I think that the important thing about Claudia, which maybe is not, it's not the first thing that you think about, but I think that one of the things that I wanted to get across is that it's the 1960s in Mexico, and so it's a quite closed society. It's very traditional, even for families that aren't that weren't Catholic. There were very strict social cores. It's quite a conservative culture. And so for someone that didn't operate within the bounds of that culture, life could be very difficult. And so Claudia is unconventional anyway. And then because of her illness, which is, she's manic depressive. I refer to it as manic depression rather than bipolar because I think that the term bipolar is very clinical. And I think that the term manic depression gets at some of some of what is actually happening to people, some of the the ups and downs of an actual life. And so for me, I think one of the important things about Claudia is not just the fact that she has this illness, which I don't name directly in the book on purpose. What's more important is that she has this illness in a particular place at a particular time, and really the kind of the limitations put on her because of that, and the ways that she acts out because of that, because of where she is and when she is there.
And this is a story that's very much told, from the point of view of her daughters, although she also has a voice in this book. But we begin with the daughters. Tell us about them. Let's start with the eldest, Rocio, who seems to be kind of the parentified child.
There's four daughters, and Rocio is, as the oldest daughter, she does become the caretaker and the parental figure as much as she can. One of the things that was difficult with Rocio for me was that I wanted to create a character who was both overwhelmed by what she was in to the point of not really seeing it, but also incredibly lucid about things without having any sense of her own lucidity. So she's constantly doubting herself. She'll recount something, and as she's recounting it, she will say, "I'm not sure if this is how it happened. I don't really remember this clearly." She's constantly negating her statements. And what I was trying to get at a little bit with her was that sense of knowing and not knowing, or knowing something that's so horrible that you block it, that you can't know it. So she's that person who's not really fully there in some ways, at the same time that she's the one that has to be fully there because she's taking care of her younger sisters as much as she possibly can. She's also, because she refuses to see things and kind of runs away from things from the time she's quite young, turns away from things, doesn't physically run away, but turns away from things. She sets up a life for herself that's very different from the life that her parents have provided for her, and gets married very young and has quite a safe life. That's the way that she saves herself. The book opens with the youngest sister, and I do think of them as kind of bookends. The youngest sister is actually, I probably shouldn't say this, but she's my favorite of the characters, of the sisters. And I think that the reason that I like her so much is because I think of her as the historian. I think of her as the poet. I think that the places where her mind seems to seep a bit and where she's not quite sure of the firmament of her world, I think those places where, for Claudia, we see that as madness. With Sandra, when she starts having these minor breakdowns, for her it's much more closely aligned to a poetic sensibility, and she moves really in that direction, and we have a faith that she is operating in a different way from other people, perhaps, but that what's driving her is this artistic sensibility, which a friend of hers' father sees in her quite early on and tells her he sees it in her. And when he points it out to her, she denies it. But I think that sensibility is one of the things that I really love about Sandra.
And you've also given her, some special sensibilities in other ways, a kind of extrasensory sensibility.
Yeah, she's very sensitive to the world around her. From the time she's very young, she thinks that she is her older sister who's been given away. That space, the space between her and her older sister, collapses for her a lot throughout her life. She also sees things. She thinks that there may be this spirit that kind of guides her when she's very young. I think that all of the girls, except for Marta, perhaps Marta has it too in a very different way, have a way to take care of themselves and to deal with the fact of a mad mother. And for Sandra, it really is going into these kind of magical places that she goes into. And she does have that kind of extreme sensitivity, which can feel like boundarylessness sometimes, which is what madness is. So she can feel to a reader on the cusp of that at times, even though I think that the way I wrote her, or the way that I meant to write her, was not as someone who's mad, but as someone who's extremely sensitive and has this artistic sensibility and this kind of ability to seep out and in without really going fully into madness ever.
She's on the healthy side of those awarenesses. I think R.D. Lang, you know, for example, the psychologist R.D. Lang often said that those who are mad are really seeing, they're seeing a reality that is real, that there are things there that the rest of us, you know, are too distracted really to see. And so in some sense, I'm hearing that in you, but there's a difference between doing that in being healthy and seeing that and not being healthy.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that there is a hypersensitivity. If you've been around someone who's mentally ill, there is a hypersensitivity that you don't really see in a lot of other places. And I do think that it can go to places that are uncontrollable. And I think that Sandra definitely is on the healthy side of that, and Claudia isn't. Claudia also she doesn't have an outlet for it at all, or any sense of an understanding of it. Yeah.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're speaking with novelist Veronica Gonzalez Pena about her latest book, The Sad Passions. And have you been around somebody who was manic depressive?
Yeah. My mother actually is manic depressive, and so for me this was an incredibly difficult book to write. Not just structurally, as you were referring to at the beginning of our conversation, because structurally the book was quite difficult to write. It's 5 first person narrations, really 6, because at one point Claudia's the mother's sister comes in and she gives this kind of sweeping, very fast sweeping overview of things, which kind of shift everything for us a little bit. But that structure of the voices that kind of weave in and out of each other, and the fact that they're all first-person narrations was quite a difficult thing to manage at times. I'm very interested in point of view and perspective, and the idea of the same fact, the same event, being experienced in these multitudinous ways. That, I think, is, if I think of like a philosophy or a way that I think about writing or even about just my sensibility, that's quite key to me. I don't think there is a right. For me, everything kind of happens in this subjective and internalized way. And so that kind of structuring was very complicated and took a lot out of me. But I think the more difficult thing was writing from the point of view of someone who is manic depressive. That was quite a stretch for me. And it was very important to me also to be completely, you know, to not sentimentalize it and not romanticize mental illness was also an objective for me.
Yes, and it's a very real book. I mean, when, in the chapters in which Claudia speaks, I mean, one's heart goes out to her. You know, one understands the fear in which she lives, and I think you do that very well. And I had the sense that you were the character Julia, who is given away, taken away from her mother basically at the age of 6, and ends up living, at least in part of the book, on the North Fork of Long Island, which is a place that you also have lived in and go to.
Well, I think that you and I had spoken about the North Fork earlier, because I do indeed go to the North Fork. I've been going there for summers since I've been back in Los Angeles. So for about 13 or 14 years, I go and spend the summer on the North Fork. But I think that in terms of my writing or my ideas about fiction and storytelling, one of the things that I play around with is that line between fiction and nonfiction, and what's real and what isn't real. And I, like all writers, do draw from my life and other people's lives. This is the danger in having a friend who's a writer. And there are, I guess, very important parts of Julia's story that are my story. I was brought up by my godfather. I left Mexico City at 6. My mother gave me up to my godfather, and I was brought up by him. I went from Mexico City to Athens, Ohio. He was a literature professor in Ohio at the university. So there are places where Julia's story and my story collide. There's one point in the book, a bit of the quite early history in the book is also loosely based on my familial history. So my great-grandparents did come from France to Mexico to help set up the railroad. I use a name that is a familial name. The great-grandfather's name in the book is Kutsel, and that is my great-grandfather's name. And I thought quite seriously about that and about how much I wanted to use from my own story in order to play with these lines between fiction and nonfiction. But it's always important for me that that be seen as an authorial gesture, as something that I'm doing consciously, that it's something that I think about quite seriously in terms of writing, the places where things slip in and out of story. I think we're constantly making story, that everything becomes story. And so I think about those spaces quite seriously. And it was very, very late in the book that I put in an actual familial name into the story. So this Kutsel character, who gets mentioned once in the entire book, I changed that name maybe a week before I handed in the novel, in order to kind of create that tension, the tension between the real and the not real, the factual and the invented.
Could you say more about what does fascinate you about that that line between reality and fiction as a novelist? Why do you play with that?
I think that the most fascinating aspect for me exists outside of fiction. So I think that we all approach fiction as something that is invented. When we read, we're giving ourselves up and entering a place that isn't our place. And we enter it without anything on, really. We just go in as much as we possibly can and take it as story. It's thrilling for me as a reader to read something where I've entered that space, the space of story. It happens to me in film too, because I'm quite interested in film. When something suddenly plays upon my expectation and things kind of turn upside down for me, those are places I get so excited when that happens that I have to stop reading, walk away from the book, and then come back to it. There's one place in The Ambassadors, the Henry James novel, where you've been reading this third-person narration, and close to page 400, you're like on page 385, it goes into a first person. There's an I, and it happens once in the entire book. And when you read that I, everything turns upside down for you. You start wondering, who is this I? Where did this come from? What's going on here? Those places for me are so titillating and exciting that I work quite hard at inserting that kind of an experience for a reader in as poetic a way as I can. But in terms of like my larger idea of what story is, I feel quite, it's quite a serious thing for me, the idea of story and point of view and perspective in terms of everything that gets told, the way that things get told. I think that any time that someone is telling a fact, the fact is from their point of view, and that already is a story, and that is what fascinates me. I like reading case histories. I read a lot of case histories, and the places where there's something being told and the analysis of the thing being told at the same time is what fascinates me, so that I'm constantly approaching things as fiction anyway. For me, everything that I look at is fiction the moment it gets told.
So when you say case histories, are you talking about like therapeutic case histories, psychological ones?
Yeah. I love Winnicott and Freud. Yeah. So, I get a lot from reading case histories. I pull a lot of things out from them for my fiction. And those kinds of slips in the telling of the self are things that are really fascinating to me.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with novelist Veronica Gonzalez-Pena about The Sad Passions. It's her latest novel. And your use of photos, I mean, it reminded me very much, especially the sections of the book, usually in Julia's chapters, where it's very much like one of my other favorite writers, which is W.G. Zabald. Was he a conscious inspiration to you for these sections of the book, where you use actual photos? So when we're talking about reality and fiction, I mean, you're inserting these incontrovertibly real representations of reality right into your story.
Yeah, that's another place. I mean, I think that this happens, you know, when I say that this is something I think about quite seriously, I layer this in many different ways. So one of the ways was with this name. Another thing was collapsing Julia into myself at several points throughout the book. And another way is through the use of actual art and actual artists. And Julia is meant to be an art historian. And she's writing, she's attempting to write her first book and is writing about these artists. And that also collapses for her. There's all these places where the book collapses into itself and creates this kind of emotional, you know, tornado. I open the book with this image of a tornado, and that happens, I think, over and over again in the book. Julia will be thinking about her mother and then move out into thinking about art. And there will be these images of the art, different artists that she's thinking about. So there's some, throughout the book, there's all these different artists. But there's other times when she is thinking about artists, and I think this happens most poignantly with Francesca Woodman and Hans Bellmer, where she's thinking about her mother and does these kind of moves into these essayistic things about these artists, or starts out with the essayistic and moves, that collapses into her thinking about her mother, so that she's constantly moving back and forth between these places. Yeah. Sabled for me, the fact that in the beginning when I was first working on the book, I didn't have images. And at a certain point, I realized that because I was referring to very specific works of art, and that might not be accessible to all readers, that it would really help if I had the images in the book. And I inserted them into one section, and it kind of shifted everything for me. And I realized that it completed the book for me and turned it into something else. And of course, I did think of Sabald, and you know, I love his writing. He's one of my favorite writers. And so it's definitely a nod toward him. And I felt, it was something that I could do as part of the fabric of the book and make it work within the structure of the thing as a whole.
And the connection between the personal and the non-personal, between the artists and moving back and forth between the commentary on the artists like Francesca Woodman, and then that sparking a connection to thinking about her mother. I mean, how does one bring up the other in the context of your writing here?
Well, I think that it works differently in each instance. So when it's about Hans Bellmer, it's meant to be very clearly this relationship to the female body that Bellmer has, and Claudia's relationship to her body, again, in Mexico City in the 1960s, when women were supposed to behave in a certain way. You know, men could be out doing whatever they wanted to do, but women, there was not supposed to be a woman's sexuality, and certainly not the woman's sexuality that happens with manic depression. This is not something that gets talked about very much, but I think it's a very significant part of manic depression, is that that's one of the boundaries that falls away, is the boundary of sexuality. So for someone like Claudia, moving through that space in the way that she does further stigmatizes her outside of the madness and everything else. So that Bellmer chapter is very pointedly supposed to be dealing with that. And I chose him as an artist because of the way that he plays with the body. Francesca Woodman, I felt, also was a correlation to Claudia and to Claudia's attempted suicides or suicidal thoughts. But then there are other places where Julia is thinking about art, and her much more abstract ideas about art move into ideas about her mother. So there's this artist, Robert Barry, who did this series of works where he would release gases into the air and would do this in the desert a lot. And when she's thinking about Robert Barry, that's what she's thinking. She thinks about this kind of this release of self and the way that things shift and affect even when you can't see them. And so that becomes this kind of more philosophical idea, which is quite theoretical, about Robert Barry's work, and then moves into ideas about her mother and how her mother has affected her and also everyone around her, even though those effects are not necessarily, there's not necessarily a line. So I think that the art functions differently in each of the sections, and it's always in relation to what Julia is thinking about in terms of the book, but also in terms of her mother, and those two things seem to be intertwined.
This is a book that is very centered on the female experience. It explores the layers of identity, the way we think about our identity, how we define ourselves in relationship to other people, and struggle to find who we are truly in ourselves. I mean, I'm thinking, for example, on page 129, Rocio is talking about her mother, how she seeped into her so that when she wasn't around, it was as if she were. And she wonders if she has a will at all. I mean, I think these are very easy on different levels for all women to think about, and all the characters do in a different way. I mean, even Marta, who is kind of the bad girl and takes after her mother more than any of the others. Well, she's taking after her mother, and yet in such a way as she's proclaiming loudly to the world, I'm here and you better pay attention to me and I'm not going to do what you want me to do.
Well, I think that, in terms of identity, I think it's quite complex how we're formed. And I think that that's one of the things that looks like this layering effect in the book, is the fact that I'm dealing with these different characters who, the original title of the book was Synecdoche, and then I thought, you know, I should maybe change that because I decided to make it something a little more poetic.
What was it? What was the word?
Synecdoche.
Synecdoche.
The piece that is a part of the whole. It's a poetic term that means the piece that's a part of the whole, that can't, like, become disengaged from the whole. Huh. And so that was going to be the original title. But there's a Charlie Kaufman movie that is, right when I was starting the book, this film came out with the same title, and I thought, oh, God, I can't do that. And I was thinking about the book in terms of how this character affects everyone else so deeply that they are almost a part of her, and each have to find a way to kind of function in the world in relation to and in spite of and because of and whatever other terminology you can use in terms of relations. But I think that's how we all, this is an extreme case because we're dealing with madness, and what that does to interrelational experiences is quite extreme. But I think that we all go through that sense of how do we become who we become? How, where is it, is there choice involved? Where is it reaction? The title actually comes from a term by that Deleuze applies to Spinoza, and it's the sad passions. And the sad passions are the reactive passions, the emotions that are reactive as opposed to active. So things like anger or longing or sadness, the things that keep you reacting to other people and things as opposed to acting in the world. And so that's why I ended up with this title, because it was close enough to that idea of how and at what point you're making your own life. And I had someone who is an analyst actually ask me about the sisters and ask me whether I felt that there was hope in the book. And I said I did. I felt like at the end of the book there is a sense of hope. And she asked me why I felt that there was hope for the characters that there was. And I told her that I felt it was because they were active, you know, that the two of the characters I felt were active and were at least attempting to make a life that was their own life, and that there was some agency involved for them, that they weren't just reactive. So the whole idea of, like, of identity and how you become who you become, I think we're all involved in that all the time, constantly. And I certainly hope that it's a book that's interesting to men as well as women, although I do recognize that it's a very feminine book and that it's inhabited by women who are very much in the world without a lot of men. You know, the presence of the men is kind of peripheral in this book. I like that.
And did you have do you have sisters?
I do have sisters. Yeah, I do.
And did they stay with your mother?
They did. They did. Although, you know, not always. Everyone was kind of raised by different people because of the mental illness again. And they're all quite different. My sisters are quite different from me, yeah, and quite different from each other, and have dealt with their relation to my mother in each in a very unique way, yeah.
And have they read this book?
They're in the process of reading it.
Have you gotten any reactions from them in terms of, you know, that they may have said to you, yeah, that's, I'm not even going after your own necessarily personal family history, because there were moments in the book where I could say, oh, I could really relate to, for example, Rocio. So some of these, you don't have to have a parent who's mentally ill to have some of these struggles, but, but I just wonder if they, you know, they said, yeah, you know, you got that right. That's what I went through.
Yeah, there has been a lot of that. Of course, there has been a lot of, like, the kind of the sense of the book, the emotion of the book, the kind of the driving, you know, the sense of almost floating at times, or the way that language, that the language is very kind of immersive. I think that is what has resonated most, that sense of having to kind of pull out of this very kind of immersive space and experience that you have when you are around not necessarily just a parent that's mentally ill. It could be a sibling or a friend or a lover,
or a child.
Yeah, it's quite that sense that I hope I'm able to create in the book is what I think resonates the most.
Well, it is a wonderful novel, The Sad Passions. Thank you so much, Veronica Gonzalez-Pena, for speaking with us here on Writer's Voice about it, and I look forward to more from you.
Thank you, Francesca. It was great.
Veronica Gonzalez-Pena. In addition to The Sad Passions, she's also the author of Twin Time, or How Death Befell Me. Next up, Carl Safina talks trash. Plastic trash. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Artists and scientists on the trail of plastic garbage on Alaska's beaches.
We were going to maybe the most beautiful place in the world, and instead of being convened by the beauty, we're convened by the garbage.
We've secured scientists and artists to examine this global ocean tragedy.
artists and scientists share a lot of the same concerns, but they approach them with a totally different toolbox.
It's the integration of art and science, understanding the scientific content, but to then strike people emotionally.
The whole project is unusual, but we're also in not only unusual times, we're in unprecedented times.
The plastic debris has been accumulating here basically ever since we started using plastics. It's predictable where the trash will end up.
We took 40 tons of plastic off these beaches right here.
These are the ghosts of our consumption. The cultural archaeology of our time right now.
I particularly hate these because I've seen albatrosses dead and packed with them.
Marine debris is a global tragedy. You have to touch a person's soul in order to change their behaviors.
That's a clip from the trailer for a new short film out from National Geographic, Gyre. Creating art from a plastic ocean. When we think Alaska, we tend to think of snow-capped mountains, deep conifer forests, and pristine beaches. But many of those beaches have become garbage dumps for millions of tons of plastic trash being washed up by ocean currents. They come from the Alaska Gyre, circulating currents that pick up plastic floating in the ocean from consumer packaging to commercial fishing gear to whole shipping containerfuls of plastic knickknacks. And it's killing wildlife. Some animals think it's lunch. Others get entangled in it. Ecologist Carl Safina went with a team of other scientists and some artists to document what's going on. The scientists were there to find out what's the impact of that trash. The artists were there to make art out of trash and thereby spark the awareness of the public. Their work will become part of a traveling exhibition beginning in Anchorage, Alaska in February 2014. But you can view the National Geographic short documentary about the project, narrated by Safina, right now on YouTube. Carl Safina is the award-winning author of The View from Lazy Point and A Sea in Flames, both books he's told us about on Writer's Voice, as well as many other books and writings. He's the director of the Blue Ocean Institute and the producer and host of the PBS series Saving the Ocean. Carl Safina, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Great pleasure to be back.
This film, Gyre, Creating Art from a Plastic Ocean, tell us a little bit about how this project came about.
Well, it was the brainchild of Howard Ferrin at the Alaska Sea Life Center in Seward, Alaska, in conjunction with the Anchorage Art Museum. And the vision was to, you know, help expose this issue, not just with words and information about how many tons of plastic or what kinds of things are on the beaches, but to actually better show it to people and to do that by bringing artists and videographers along with scientific-type people on this really, I think, unique, one-of-a-kind kind of expedition.
Now, tell us a little bit about these gyres. You went to visit the Alaska, is that what it's called, the Alaska Gyre?
Well, not really. I mean, there's a gyre in maybe every ocean, which just means that the ocean has a circulating current that is generally circular. And there are many smaller ones, too, depending on the way that the coastlines are configured. And it just means a current that goes around in a circle, basically. And because it does, you know, the ocean tends to continually collect plastic, especially, that we manage to put into the ocean in a variety of ways. So there's a Pacific gyre, there's an Atlantic gyre, there are various gyres, there's an Alaska gyre, actually. And it just means that the current is circulating, but at the edge of those circles, it also sometimes can spit things back out, and they wind up on the beaches. But the other thing is that naming the project Gyre is a metaphor as well for the idea that what goes around comes around.
Mm. Yes. You were shocked. I mean, you've been an ecologist for a long time. You've done this work mostly centered around the health of our oceans. You're the head of the Blue Ocean Institute, and yet you were shocked. What did you find?
I found that even in Alaska, which we mostly think of as a place very remote from most people, that on a lot of the beaches, there is just an incredible amount of plastic stuff that is accumulating all the time. And I was not really prepared for how much of it there was and how widespread it was. Having said that, there is a lot of the coastline in Alaska that is extremely high energy and very dynamic. And in the winter, the storms are very, very rough. And there are these spectacular cliffs that plunge down almost right to the shoreline. And nothing really accumulates there. And then there are lots of quieter coves where everything accumulates. So as you go along in a ship, if you're looking with binoculars, you can look for those beaches where you can see lots of logs from a distance. And where the logs have piled up and accumulated, if you land on any of those beaches, you'll see that there are just tons and tons of plastic as well now.
Well, describe a typical beach that you found with this plastic.
Most of the beaches that accumulate a lot of the plastic, they're sort of coves. They're quieter. That makes them sandier. They have a lot of drift logs, and they have lots and lots of plastic. In Alaska, a lot of the plastic was commercial fishing stuff in addition to a lot of household. And also things that obviously came from cargo ships where in storms, these big containers that on land get hooked up to tractor trailers, these things get washed overboard and broken open. And so we found on many, many beaches, we found these fly swatters that were shaped like football helmets with the logo of a sports team on them. We found on many beaches hummingbird feeders, a very strange thing, I thought. But those obviously had been in some big shipment of those things, and that's why we kept finding them on different beaches. And then we also found lots of, things that you would find in the home. Drink bottles, soap bottles, things that are more recognizable that you would have around the house and toss out. But some of those came from Asia and had Asian writing on them, so they had come a long way.
So other than the aesthetic problems with garbage, what are the problems of garbage? Do they pose any kind of danger to the wildlife?
Animals frequently get tangled up in plastic garbage. Of course, netting that is drifting around tangles a lot of things. That's what it's designed to do. And it creates danger and misery to fish and turtles and seals and sea lions and occasionally dolphins and whales and seabirds and things like that. And other animals eat plastic. Sometimes they die from impacted plastic in their intestines or in their stomach. Some kinds of animals may mistake plastic for something like a jellyfish. If they eat, like sea turtles eat jellyfish, they tend to eat a lot of plastic bags that they seem to mistake for their food. Because in the whole history of the world, the only thing that looked like a plastic bag in the ocean was a jellyfish. And now there are other things that look like jellyfish, and they're not jellyfish, and there's no way that they have to understand that. So the stuff that we find washed up on the beaches kind of represents the current destination or the current resting place of stuff that is very hazardous while it's moving around in the water to all of the many millions of things that live in the water. We were in a place that people call remote, but lots of other animals call it home, and it matters to them, and it affects them, and they don't deserve it, you know.
And in fact, you found a couple who live in probably one of the most remote places imaginable, Colleen and Jerry, who, as you say in the film, probably moved there to go to the most remote, beautiful place they could find, and then they found a lot of garbage. Tell us about them.
Yeah, they live in a place where their nearest neighbor is 25 miles away, and the nearest town is 60 miles in one direction and 80 miles in another direction. And their idea, obviously, was to be in a wild and beautiful place with animals and with natural beauty and not with all of our garbage. But on a lot of the beaches surrounding them, there's increasing amounts of trash. And now she spends a fair amount of her time collecting it in very large quantities and then trying to, you know, get somebody to barge it out.
Now, we haven't yet mentioned the other part of this project, which was to actually make art out of the plastic. Tell us about some of the artists in the project and their reaction to what they found.
Well, it was interesting, the reaction, because on the one hand, they were, dismayed and I guess as disappointed and as turned off as anybody. But on the other hand, it also excited them as far as their ability to create things as a way of showing the rest of us what it's like there. And some of them are sculptors. They take these pieces and they make things out of them. Some do that in addition to painting or representing them in various collections. Others were photographers who, in the one case, Andy Hughes, he makes the garbage look as though it is something that has dropped in from outer space. And it's a little hard to describe that. A lot of his stuff looks sort of, to me, like Magritte paintings. These very realistic representations of things, but in a very surreal sort of arrangement or positioning. And, you know, it's interesting. It does get people talking, and the visual representations are worth a thousand words, as they say.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. And we should tell our listeners that they can go and see the entire film on YouTube. This is going to be an exhibition that goes worldwide, an exhibition of the art. Is that right?
Yeah, it's going to premiere in February at the Anchorage Art Museum, if anybody feels like going to Anchorage, Alaska in February. But then it's going to travel around quite a bit, and it will spend some time in Smithsonian and I guess a lot of other museums. And in the meantime, the film is viewable on the Internet. You look for Gyre, G-Y-R-E, Expedition. And I guess if you put in Gyre, Alaska, it should come up right away on YouTube or on the National Geographic website.
Now, I'd like to ask you some questions also about other pollution in the oceans besides plastic. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
I was reading a book by Rebecca Solnit, The Far Away Nearby. We'll be airing that interview soon. And in that book, she talks for she goes to the Arctic, and she talks about the pollution that's there. She said actually that some breast milk in indigenous women has been called hazardous waste, that the wildlife up there are extraordinarily contaminated with toxins. Is this so? And if so, why? Why are they more contaminated in such a remote region?
Well, I'm not sure who might have called the milk, the women's milk, toxic waste. I don't know if that's an official thing or not, but there is, they do have more chemicals in their bodies than most of us. And that's because many of those people still eat a lot of wild animals at the very top of the food chain. They do still hunt and eat things like seals. And the higher an animal is on the food chain, the more its body has collected all of the contamination from everything there is below it. So if you think of all of the little tiny plankton in the ocean, they are they're extremely small. Some of them are microscopic. Some of them are just plain tiny. And they have very, very tiny amounts of our toxic pollution in their bodies that they have gotten from the water around them. And then the small fish that eat them will accumulate a lot of the toxins, so they concentrate it because they're getting it from all of those little tiny things that they eat. And every step up from the smallest fish to the slightly larger fish to the largest fish to seals and things like dolphins and killer whales, every time it takes a step up, the animal has accumulated the toxic chemicals or many of the toxic chemicals from all of the stuff that it has eaten and all the stuff that what it has eaten has eaten. So it concentrates in this sort of pyramid. And usually, if humans are involved in that food chain, they're involved at a pretty late stage, pretty high up in that food chain. So we get a bigger dose. So, when we eat fish, if you eat a small fish, you get a small dose of things like PCBs or mercury. If you eat a big old fish, you get a bigger dose. If you eat something that eats nothing but fish, it has gotten a lot of those doses and has accumulated a lot, and then you get all of that. So it's unfortunately a pretty efficient way of transferring a lot of pollution directly into your body. And if you happen to be one of the people we sometimes collectively call Eskimos, who still eat lots and lots of fish and still eat lots and lots of seals, they have more chemicals on average in their body than we do. But on the other hand, if you ate nothing but big fish, you know, if you had tuna sushi 14 times a week, you would probably get mercury poisoning.
Wow.
Like somebody I know who got a debilitating case of mercury poisoning and had no idea what was happening to him until it was diagnosed. And then after several years of not touching a fish, he's just about recovered.
Wow. Now, plastic itself is toxic. I mean, we know about the estrogenic effects of plastic. When the animals, like the albatross and the bears, you talk about the bears tend to be attracted to plastic, to eat it, as are the albatrosses, does that have a toxic effect on them?
Well, it can. And the thing is that there's, you know, there is such a thing as plastic, but plastic is many things. You know, to say that they're eating plastic is like saying we're eating food or we're wearing cloth. There's a lot of different kinds of food, there's a lot of different kinds of cloth, and there's a lot of different kinds of plastic. Some plastic has toxic chemicals in it, and some pretty much does not. So it really depends, and it's not easy to tell. One of the things on our gyre expedition that we were doing that was very interesting was we had a couple of machines on board, and a woman from the Smithsonian Institution was able to look at the composition of what was in some of the plastic pieces. And some of them, you could have eaten them and been fine if you broke them up into small enough pieces. Others had things like lead and various other things that would poison you if you ate them. So you can't just tell by looking at them. And even things that are made for the same purpose are sometimes manufactured in different factories with some different additives. And you may look at two things that look like they're made for the same purpose and look identical, but they don't have the same chemical composition. So it's a pretty complicated subject.
And one that inspires one to think of, if we must create plastic, we need to create non-toxic plastic.
Yes, that's right. And also, I think we need to scale the plastic to the use. For instance, we put yogurt in plastic containers. The yogurt may be good for 3 weeks, and the plastic lasts for eternity. Why do we put something that is good for 3 weeks in an eternal package? It doesn't make any sense.
So what are some solutions that you would suggest for this problem of the plastic trash in the oceans?
Well, the main solution will have to be that this stuff that we call plastic, that is in many cases extremely useful, needs to be manufactured in a way that it will not last forever, that it will be able to actually really break down, not just break into smaller pieces, but really break down, be metabolized by bacteria, and become harmlessly recycled in a way that matches its use. I wouldn't want a boat to break up in salt water and sunlight in less than 50 years, but I certainly would want a drink container to be completely digested by bacteria within a year or less. The other thing is that as far as the fishing gear, people need to understand, which currently I don't think we do, why there is so much fishing gear in the water. Is it that it washes overboard in storms, or is it that it costs money to discard it on land, where you have to bring it to a landfill and pay a fee? And if it's mainly the latter, then we need to have different kinds of policies where these kinds of things can be disposed of for free, or you pay a deposit when you buy a fishing net, and then you get the deposit back when you bring it to a recycling center or throw it away. So currently, we don't even really understand why all this stuff is in the ocean, whether it's an accident or whether it's being done on purpose.
Right, and don't cruise ships also do a lot of dumping into the ocean?
Well, I don't know the answer to that question at this point. It is illegal everywhere in the world for cruise ships to dump plastic, or for any ships to dump any plastic. And for a few years after that policy, there were a lot of cruise ships that were still just throwing all their garbage overboard. I think that for the most part, that is behind us now. And I certainly hope it is. It's certainly a lot less than it used to be when it was the routine way of dealing with it.
So what do you hope people who view this film, and I hope everybody will, what do you wish for them to do? Is there anything they can do other than maybe be more conscious about recycling their own plastic?
We can be much more thoughtful about and careful about recycling our plastic, asking or demanding that if we live in places where the plastic is not recycled, that we get recycling programs. And just go to places and buy things where it doesn't come wrapped in an insane amount of plastic garbage. I recently saw figs that were in a hard plastic shell where each fig had its own little space like in an egg carton. But it was a hard plastic thing. Now, there's no reason to sell figs that way. I went and I bought a little basket of figs, a pint of figs, in a little cardboard container rather than a big plastic shell. So I think that kind of thinking could go a long way. It would be nice if simply nobody could make any money selling something like individually wrapped figs in plastic shells. I just found that so insane.
Well, the film is Gyre, Creating Art from a Plastic Ocean. It's 20 minutes long. It's free to watch on the internet, and it's really terrific. It's quite inspiring. Thanks so much, Carl Safina, for talking with us about it.
Well, thank you very much.
Carl Safina has just been nominated for the 2014 Indianapolis Prize, the world's leading award for animal conservation. Go to writersvoice.net to see the trailer for Gyre, as well as a link to the whole film on YouTube. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.